Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lena says this: it's a hit or miss, but the standard fantasy animal sidekick cliche. Lena, sidekick animals are always cool. They're never done wrong, and you're the problem. That's all I have to say.
That's pretty fair. Da, 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 da.
Welcome back, everybody, to another Two to Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm your other host, Richard.
Today, we are talking about cliches, the worst cliches. And Rich, not just our least favorite cliches, which we'll get to, but Rich, these are cliches that were submitted by them.
The peons?
The audience.
Ugh, terrible.
They participated because we—
Ugh, gross.
Rich, we—
The opinions of sheep.
Rich, we asked them to.
Oh, then okay.
we asked.
Then it's fine, I guess. As long as they're doing what they're told, that's
keep
important.
Keep them in line.
Keep them in line. You know, herd them like sheep. Yes.
So we asked you all on Instagram, on Twitter/X, on YouTube community tabs. If you didn't see any of that, go ahead, follow us or put the notification bell on YouTube, because then you'll see when we post stuff like this to participate in videos and more. And also, our patrons submitted, and we're going to talk about our patrons' least favorite cliches. They pay us. We love them. And they join us for a book club every month on Discord. It's great, where we host a book club. It's a lot of fun. We're going to be doing our vote soon for next month, so we'll see. But anyways, this video is going to be out too late for this to be relevant toward our next book club. And anyways, check out Patreon. Check out our social media to participate in these future videos. So Rich, let's first, before we talk about what their least favorite cliches are, we're going to get to the number one, two, three, what their least were. What is the difference between a cliche and trope, and what is your least favorite cliche, not trope? Distinguish those two.
Sure.
Then we'll get into it.
Both cliches and tropes fall under the umbrella of patterns of storytelling. So
indeed,
both can be a pattern that a story goes through in these things that you see in other stories. However, a trope is typically a more positive action, because patterns are fine. You don't have to be completely original every single time. It's just not how storytelling works. However, with a cliche, it comes with the connotation of something that is wholly unoriginal, something that detracts from the story or breaks immersion. In some way, it is a pattern of storytelling that detracts from the overall story.
Yeah, good way of putting it. And I'm taking that from definition here and a little bit of what you're saying. Maybe trope is just pattern that's useful, a useful tool, and cliche is unoriginal and uninspired.
Sure.
So when we're talking cliches, these are tropes that can even lean more into it. It's so much of a pattern that you did nothing new with the trope. You didn't even try. It's just—
you didn't put a spin on it. You didn't try to integrate it into the rest of your story. It just kind of feels—
like math.
Yeah.
We don't come to read stories for math.
I don't like math. No.
No, I stay away from math. So, Rich, before we get to their number one least favorite cliche, what is yours? What do you hate more than anything?
Irrationally hate?
Yeah.
Oh, I've talked about it several times.
I shouldn't have asked, yeah.
You shouldn't have asked. But it's, they don't tell the plan, it's going to work. If they tell the plan, it's going to go wrong. You see it in all the heist movies. You see it in a lot of these stories. And at this point, when it's done so many times, I now know what's going to happen in the story, and it breaks my immersion. What is your least favorite cliche?
They all reminded me of several that I hate. So there's some on here that I'm now thinking, wait, maybe I hate this one more than the one I'm thinking I hate. But my go-to is always the moral character who kills all the henchmen and all the cannon fodder and then won't kill the big bad because they suddenly go, oh, I can't kill them because I'd be stooping to their level. When the whole entire story, you stoop to their level.
That is objectively worse. I have the irrational least favorite. Like, honestly, it's not a huge detractor. That's a worse one. But for me, it has ruined so many stories.
You know, teach their own.
It's a personal thing of just like, oh, that's a real annoying.
Yeah.
You know, it teeters my totter is what it does.
I'm touched.
There you go.
Teeters your totter?
We have shirts that say that.
Oh, that was so nice.
You're welcome.
We'll get right back to this cliche podcast episode with a very cliche advertisement from our one and only sponsor, Displate.
Displate, the best company ever. I don't think it exists. Something better. Am I saying that because they're paying me?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. I kind of are.
But Displate.
Displate.
They are offering 27 to 33% off if you purchase a Displate in the next 4 days from watching this video. It goes down to 22 to 30% off if you use the code 22RAMBLE.
A whole 22 to 30% off.
22 to 30% off.
If they use the code 2 to ramble.
2 to ramble.
2 to ramble gets you 22 to 30% off.
If they go onto displate.com/2toramble.
Oh my God. Who knew that if you could use the code 2 to ramble, you could get 22 to 30% off?
Sham wow. If you want to get 22 to 33%, I think we got the. It's a lot of percentages points that are off, and Displate is kind enough to let us do these very weird advertisements for their great products.
I'm going to bet they actually don't watch our ads when we do it.
Victor's the best. He watches everything we do.
No, doesn't.
Just fine.
Hey, Victor, if you ever watch our...
Now, Displate, just to give you a quick thing, they are magnetic posters. They have sponsored us time and time again. Please go check them out. They have been kind enough to sponsor two old hooligans like us, and they are quality products. We would not take an advertisement from someone otherwise. We love them, use them. They're fantastic. We'll get right back to the cliche podcast episode. See y'all soon.
Thanks for listening.
So now the number one trope people, sorry, cliche, almost stumbled there. The number one cliche people hate the most is the chosen one trope when it becomes a cliche.
That makes sense, especially the frequency of it. It's everywhere.
This is the most submissions we got, and I can give off some of the opinions here of what people, why people hate the chosen one trope when it turns to cliche. What do you think they said? Why do you think people hate it, and do you hate it?
I don't, okay, yeah, I hate it when it becomes a cliche. It's not fun anymore. There is actually a certain point in your life where if your life is not going so well and you want that self insert character, you want to, if your life itself is chaos and you don't feel like the main character in your own life, it's sometimes cathartic, or it just is an escape. To escape into a world where the main character is simple and is special in some way, and that the world does revolve around them. It's kind of gives into that fantasy.
We actually had a whole episode on the Chosen One trope. We talked about just that. Yeah.
So I get
you're
it.
You're getting at the good point, yeah.
But when it becomes a cliche is when the main character starts to outshine every other character there to the point where why is any other character there? You start breaking of... why is the whole world revolving around them, and then the loss of stakes.
One opinion here from Jeremy Zoll. He said, "The Chosen One is easily my least favorite cliche. To me, the idea of a character's entire fate and all their accomplishments robs them of any agency or ingenuity. Better to have them carving their own path forward, forging their own destiny." So Jeremy's opinion here isn't even, it's not even that it diminishes the other characters, but it diminishes their own could-be character growth.
That's certainly true. However, it's what he's touching on is the idea of the main character, the Chosen One. Because they're a Chosen One, they have certain privileges to the story. They have a destiny, a certain special power, or they have some kind of influence. But what doesn't come with it in when it becomes a cliche is when it doesn't really have the responsibility or the burden of that coming in. So being the Chosen One is not just all fun games. There should be a great burden. You are the Chosen One, so what's the cost? When it becomes cliche, is there is no cost. It's just, you know.
When it kind of goes into that wish fulfillment category.
Yeah.
And we have another opinion here from, again, I categorized several different submissions into this Chosen One category because some people said specifically the orphan Chosen One is what they hate. So this was by Alex submitted saying the worst, the one he hates is the orphan Chosen One because he's seen it so many times where the Chosen One's backstory, of course, they're an orphan.
Yeah.
And a little bit to touch on that, a lot of protagonists to instantly create bad situations, or if you're talking YA, if you're talking a character that is below the age of even 21, it's typically easier for the author to have the parents either not involved or absent so that the character can go on their growth and their journey. Because
it's an important relationship dynamic to write about, and it's difficult to do because then you have to write that character with there is a history in conversation that you have to then develop. But you're starting at, you know, with a bunch of history in the past rather than you have an orphan character that goes on their new journey and they meet a new person for the first time. And then you could just start right there and develop a relationship with them. And it's, I think that's easier than trying to show authenticity in a relationship right from the get-go is kind of hard.
That's true. And on top of that, the fact that if you have parents involved, it's a little harder to get away with your character going on their character journey.
Because sure. Like, why would your parents allow you to?
Harry Potter's easily able to go on his journey because he has horrible adopted parents. He's orphaned by aunt and uncle, but they're horrible to him. He easily can go on his journey. Or You have any Chosen One type character that Paul Atreides, his dad dies. Able to go on journey with mother, but little caveats there here and there.
Yeah.
But keeping having a YA, an aged character, not have the parents involved is kind of a natural, like, oh, now you can go on your life's journey. A lot of us don't grow up. Maybe, I mean, hey, our parents being around, a lot of us, maybe you don't grow to that next stage until you're the oldest in your family. Like, think your grandparents, the parents to you. Mm-hmm. Are you ever that? It puts you in a sense of responsibility that other people your age or it ages you.
Well, it's hard to have it is difficult to have an adventure when you are not the most responsible one for your ultimate. If you're not the ultimate responsible one for yourself.
Good way to put it.
It kind of, you're putting yourself in a playpen if you're not the sole person responsible for your own person.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rich, this is the second place one. So this is right behind where our audience, this is coming from you, okay? Mm-hmm. We're going to commentate on what you say, and we're going to say if we agree or disagree. I think with The Chosen One, what's your synopsis? Do you agree overall, disagree? What would you
just
say?
Because of its frequency, I would agree it's a pretty bad cliche at this point. It's used so often, especially with manga. It's heavily prevalent. It's annoying there. In everywhere else, it's the same thing.
I'd say when it becomes cliche, it's annoying, but I think I like it.
I like the trope,
and I think if the book's, if book bad, Chosen One trope bad, I think it's give or take. It can be done well, though. It's one of those that isn't inherently, it's not a type that's inherently bad.
Ultimately, the worst, the Chosen One comes with a heavy burden.
You can do a lot of interesting things with that.
That's the key thing. If the story doesn't deal with the burden of being ultimately the one responsible to save the world,
yeah,
then it, yeah, I think it's kind of boring.
Our patron Mora said that where she really does love it is in Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Yeah, well, in that,
yeah,
frequently it deals with exactly that, yeah. Precisely the burden of being the one to save the world. That's what makes it compelling.
Exactly.
Same thing with Star Wars and, you know, Anakin Skywalker. You deal with Randall Thor and the Wheel of Time. I kind of can go on the list. On King Arthur, in all honesty. You go back to some of the classics. Paul Atreides.
It's very much your hero archetype, hero's journey can be chosen ones as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It can be done well. You just have to deal with the burden of that great responsibility.
It's one of those things where a lot of these submissions that you'll see are things that are so popular that when something becomes so pervasive in stories or culture and it's used so often, it could get annoying. Because once you see, hey, so many superhero movies are out, we're over flooded with superhero movies. Now we're going, okay, we're not eager as much to go watch the next superhero movie. Whereas, hey, if Tudor Ramble starts doing 3 episodes a week, when we had 1 episode a week, people were coming to Tudor Ramble like, ah, oh, you only get 1. That's it. You only get 1. Now that you get 2, you could be more likely to go,
yeah, I'll skip this one.
Because I'll just start doing it twice a week. Don't take it for granted. We're leaving next week. So,
but what I see a lot of this is when it's a trope. A trope is a good story pattern that's worthy of repeating.
Yep.
And a cliche is basically a trope that wasn't fully understood. The Chosen One can be a cliche because they didn't understand what makes that trope compelling.
Yes.
And so it's the veneer of a trope.
Yeah, I would say my verdict then is the Chosen One trope is that. I approve. Yes, it could be done poorly. That's mine, though. I'm surprised it's number 1 from you all. So here's the number 2. This, I'm very curious what you think. Mm-hmm. This is the friend/enemy to lover. And specifically what a lot of the audience was saying was that they would prefer, they like the friend/enemy with the main character, but they would rather have it end up platonic than in the relationship. They prefer the platonic, just stay friends, or the reverse, just stay enemies, rather than having to fall in love by the end of the story.
Well, I'll be honest, I've only read 2 romantasy books. Both of them are enemies to lovers tropes.
Which are those 2, ACOTAR and Fourth Wing?
Yep. Only got the 2, so.
Yeah.
But with that, I'm kind of surprised to some degree. I know it's fairly common, but the whole enemies to lovers trope, from how it's been explained to me on the allure of it, especially from a woman's perspective, is your enemy is someone that inherently has to respect you. Like, you don't have
you respect
a,
me?
We're not enemies. We're acquaintances. That's different.
It's worse. You don't feel anything. It's just ambivalent. Apathetic.
Exactly. You got
it
right.
Yeah, it's nice.
But no, an enemy actually has to see you as a threat. Like, a proper enemy respects you enough to be antagonistic toward you. Versus a friend could just kind of be a lukewarm friend where they don't really trust you, but they want what's best for you, and it's kind of soft where there's not a guaranteed amount of respect. And so that whole enemies to lovers thing is you inherently have someone that respects you, and then you turn that into love.
Oh, so if you're down and you're feeling sad, your friend will help you. Your enemy will try to push you further because they don't want to see you at your best because they're fearful of
they
you.
They believe that you are a threat.
They think you can get out of it, and they want to push you while you're down because they fear you. So in a way, our enemies,
They believe in you
they
more.
They believe in us.
They our believe fr-
our
in
friends
you.
Think that we need them.
Yeah.
The audacity to think, I need you. Well, man, we could get into a whole snippet about this.
But I can understand with just the frequency of it, especially done poorly, of like, you guys wanted to like kill each other, and now you're just...
Want to shaft each other.
It's like...
It's something.
I understand the polar dynamics, it's fun, but like seems very frequent.
So some of the opinions here. So Gecko from our Patreon, shout out Gecko, said it's more common in YA, but characters having to be in relationships by the end of the series, let people, especially teens, be single for fuck's sake. So just emphasizing on those teenage relationships where you don't, at least books that we've read, a lot of the enemies, friends to lovers in adult books or adult fantasy, since the protagonists are older and could be in relationships, or that's not the focal point, a lot of the enemies, friends, lovers you'll see as for teens.
Yeah.
So teenage relationships, because it's a big part of, it's a big part, well, it's of
a big part of growing up, yeah, is romance.
It's, yeah,
some would say it's almost an essential part of growing up, is dealing with, at the very least, dealing with those feelings. So yeah, I'm not surprised it's a part of almost every, you know, young adult novel.
And it's tough, too, because there are real bad examples of friends and enemies to lovers. Real bad ones out there.
Sure.
Some of the romantic, I don't know.
I don't know.
There's some bad examples where
I may have two whole examples to pull from.
But I don't want to take away from the, I guess, if the friend to enemy trope, talking as a trope, if, well, it's,
Those are two things. Mm-hmm. Which do you think is worse?
Enemies or friends, yeah.
Friend to lover or enemy to lover?
So, two things. One, I think friend to lover might be, because there's just not, it's less juice, and it feels more, there's less conflict involved. At least the enemy to lover has, yeah, conflict and some, mm, sort of thing that you could spin off. I could see that trope. You could do something interesting with it.
The friend to lover thing can be just more wholesome. Like, especially you just, yeah, write it down. It's,
definitely
it
more
can
wholesome.
Be like going, oh, that's nice. It gives you the warm and fuzzies. Versus, yes, the enemy to lover is definitely
conflict.
Conflict and tension. Spice.
Now, of course, that could be done so cliche that it's annoying. So there's plenty of that out,
sure,
there.
Yeah.
Now, the friend enemy to the friend enemy situation to lover, why it's tough is, or here's what I was going to say. When it's not the focal point of the book, I think I enjoy it more. Where we, in epic fantasies that we love, there's so many friend enemies to lovers that,
yeah,
or have nothing to do with the grand scope of the story that we bypass because it's such a small portion of it. Think of the, Stormlight has plenty of them that you wouldn't at first go, it was a friends, enemies, lovers, because it wasn't the whole point of the story and plot line.
It also, with that length of time, feels far more natural.
Exactly. So you were able to build that, whereas instead of shoehorning it in quick scenes, but also think, I don't want to give any spoilers for anything, but there's plenty of in our stories that we love where it's just a side piece that's either feels more wholesome or feels like it was more deserved. So I think that you can get away with it when it's not. It gets the worst of the cliche when it's the focal point, and you could pick it apart where if you're reading the book for friends, enemies, lovers, and you don't like that relationship between them, it ruins the book.
Often
it has to work.
What I have found is where it becomes bad is that the characters feel like different people when they're together. That's what kind of annoys me. Of like, yeah, it takes me out of the story is when like your main character is with the romantic interest and they now seem like completely different person. Not just like they act differently. It's just they're now making decisions they really shouldn't be making. They are kind of breaking from their character when they're with another. And so it just kind of takes you out of the story to some degree.
Their motivation shifting in that way. And maybe some, yeah, of that is because the relationship does change them, but you're saying it in a way where it shouldn't change them in this way and they still do something differently.
Yeah, especially when they go right back to being kind of a completely different character when they're not around. It's kind of jarring. They seem like two different characters. And I'm specifically referencing Name of the Wind, by the way.
Oh.
It's one of my biggest frustrations with it, of like, I hate the character when they're together.
Man,
and then when they're
book.
Not together, he's fine. Just not annoying.
I've got to read that book.
You do.
The next trope, this is the next most hated one. A lot of ties here. So this is tied with some of the others. I fully support and endorse this bad cliche.
Okay.
This is horrible. It's very hard to get it right. It is character resurrections or fake out deaths.
Oh, yeah. No, how do you even do that well? How does that become? I don't even know if there's a trope version of that.
I think it could be done well when it's more whimsy, or the point of the resurrection or the fake out death isn't supposed to, if it's, the point isn't to punch you and make you cry over the death or want to feel the sadness, I feel so cheapened out by it when it's, hey, care about this character dying, feel the grief, then they're back, and then it makes you think back on an emotion like, you lied to make me feel that way, so now I'm no longer, oh yeah, you got a point here? Your finger's up.
Counterpoint.
Yeah.
Gandalf.
What about, yeah?
Fake out death.
Ooh, okay, good point. Knight. Gandalf.
Pretty directly. Why did that one work?
Because it's Tolkien. Besides it being Tolkien, maybe part of it with Gandalf. So Boromir, if Boromir came back, I would have been way more upset. Where Gandalf coming back, because he's more ethereal and he's a wizard, and he's my concept of him was always this omniscient more guide than he was the character.
It's not the emotional gut punch of his loss. It's more of the
growth for the characters, because him being gone allowed Frodo and the fellowship needed to happen for the fellowship. But good point on that. Yeah, that's a good point, because I think for Gandalf, it does work. But why is that? Why do you think it works, or does it not work for you?
I think it becomes almost neutral if there's another reason for it. Like their loss, their death led them to a different growth. Like, okay, now their journey, their adventure now has to take on a different path. The safety net is gone. There's something else to it. Compare that to just the best friend type deal, and the best friend dies, and it's just there for an emotional gut punch. And it doesn't change their adventure. Like, their goals don't change. The situation, nothing changes other than their death. Yeah. And then they come back. It's like, oh, that was just for the cheap emotional gut punch that you then took away. Versus Gandalf, it's, hey, wow, the story would be very different if Gandalf survived. And they got to grow on this journey without him. And then the return of Gandalf comes with its own, like, glory moments, rather than just on, haha, fooled you, I'm back.
Right. We have so movies and stuff commented, one of our audience members here said, going to go with the obvious fake deaths. Now it can be done well, like in Lord of the Rings, but can also get very annoying, like somehow Palpatine returned. So even the audience here is referencing when, hey, it can be done well here, but it's done poorly here and here. And that Gandalf portion, part of it too, maybe is from, I think there's a little bias as well today because it's such a classic. So in one way, it's not like Gandalf's death surprised me incredibly well. I guess it's one of those things that's past culture, to where it would almost like being angry that there's elves and dwarfs in there. Like, oh, how cliche are elves and dwarfs? There's a classic charm to it. And also the storytelling of Tolkien. Let's talk about our frameworks, because if today with more grim dark or more grim real kind of being realistic or gray, a lot of the gray, who's right, who's wrong, and modern fantasy with a fake out death, it's that death and gut punch is more focused on character interactions, and that story element is supposed to be shocking and jarring, and they're trying to make you feel a certain way. Whereas more classic, a classic fantasy, something with a scope like Tolkien storytelling, is more like sitting by the hearth, and you're there. I'm not there just for, I'm there for the something greater than just that death. I guess there's just a more appeal to a classic fantasy than there is when the book is going for something directly different, where, help me if I'm wrong here, with the distinguishing between genres, where are we more lenient with Tolkien than we are with a Joe Abercrombie, because Joe Abercrombie's writing a very different style of story, where Tolkien's style of story it's poetic, it is comforting, it's like a fairy tale in a way. So when I'm reading fairy tale, when I'm reading something that is less real, it's more in the wider, you get what I'm trying to get at here?
The main thing is there's more to the death and more to the return than just, oh, they're dead, now they're sad. If it's more than that, then maybe it's more acceptable.
Yeah.
To that point, I think what's even better than Gandalf's death in the fake out aspect of it is in Lord of the Rings, when Frodo is given the fake out death. that you think Frodo's dead.
Mm, right.
And now Sam has to pick up the ring. And this is in the books, right, by the way. And he's like, oh my God, Frodo's dead. I have to continue on this journey. And when I was reading it, I was so... I've read it before. I was watching the movies. I know Frodo's not dead, but I was so absorbed by it. I was like, oh my God, what is Sam going to do? And it was, and then when you find out and you hear, Frodo's alive, it's this well of emotion of one, it's close enough that you get both the emotion of Sam realizing, picking up this new burden. You see another side of him of, oh, he's willing to go that extra mile and continue on the journey. And then his relief and, oh, I'm going to go rescue Frodo. There's just, I got to know way more about Sam in that moment. And then I got that emotional wave through. I felt his emotions all through it versus a fake out death. Like, you just get the scene, oh, they're dead, I'm sad. And then, oh, they're alive again, I'm happy. There's more to it than just happy, sad.
Yes. It allows Sam's character growth. It does something other than just a reaction to the death.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Actually, so I was very firm in my I hate this trope, but those two examples with Gandalf and Frodo, I mean, it's no surprise I love Lord of the Rings. And so those are great examples to use. Even my preconceived notion that I hate that, it could still be done amazingly.
Yeah.
When figuring out why that trope is there. The trope is there for a purpose. And again, when people turn it into a cliche, it's when they miss out why that element is good in storytelling. The element here of what's good about the character, quote-unquote, fake-out death or resurrection, they're missing out. The purpose shouldn't just be to make you cry and sad. Because if that's what it does and nothing else, they're going to come back and you're going to feel cheapened by that previous emotion. And like now,
here's even better about it. So that's the death aspect. The resurrection, what's juicy and interesting is that when they come back, the relationship's different. The character that stayed alive has changed because of that death. And now the character comes back. So now you get to directly see, how much a character has changed or vice versa. So when you get to when Gandalf finally sees the rest of the fellowship, the other hobbits again, they're different. When Frodo sees Samwise again, Sam crawled up the tower and rescued him, like fought off the orcs, and Frodo's been like, my God, what happened to Sam? He's real different. Yeah. It's been like 2 hours. He's like a different person now. And you get to see that change.
It's also important with that resurrection to know what the limits to the magic is. Because in Lord of the Rings, it's very clear that Gandalf, being a wizard, could get resurrected. Elves live longer. Hobbits and humans, if one of them was more resurrected, I'd go, what's the scope of this magic? If Frodo, instead of the fake out death, could be literally brought back to life, well, then the journey of him going to Mordor, he could just keep reviving him. Revive him constantly till he gets there. So at least with Lord of the Rings, with the soft magic of Gandalf, because we don't know exactly what he can do, so it's not strict rules, we do know that he would be the figure that could be resurrected or come back versus others, where I'm not going to spoil this book at all, but Molazin, we have a book review on it. Go check out that one. But with a book like that, the problem that I sometimes have with resurrections or fake out deaths, resurrection specifically, is not knowing what the limits are. Because
it takes away a lot of the stakes.
Yeah. If resurrecting takes away the stakes of, characters can just come back and I just need to know what the limits are so that the author can't just do anything. And then if you can bring someone back to life, there should be strict rules, or at least you understand.
Or at least consequences.
They
come back, but something's... they paid a price. There's something to it.
Yeah, they're not the same, right? Because if that could happen, then when deaths in the future continue to happen in the book, I'm going to be in the back of my mind going, wait, isn't there the nuclear option? Can't they just do this? Mm-hmm. So, you know what? I don't hate it as much as when we started the conversation.
Good. I'm doing my job right. I'm going to convince you into liking all these.
Did you change your mind on it too?
Yeah, I was just kind of, like, I didn't like it either, but because... it's you. I'm trying to, you know, be antithetical to you.
That was helpful. This is making me think now. I'm like, that's great. So this next one, okay, I'm going to double down.
Are we just doing this whole thing of cliches and we're going to convince you
that they're good?
The listener of why they're actually good.
Rich, I want to see the mental gymnastics you can make. Good. This next cliche, there is no way you can convince me that it's good. Tune in like a minute when he convinces me because the submissions they're giving, it's just so compelling. Okay. Here's the cliche. The angsty teen, you're so smart and competent cliche. They're more smart than the adults in the world. And here I'm combining some of these. So being smart and not shown, being smarter than everyone else and never showing their actual intelligence. They're just smarter than everybody because they're 13 and they know science better than every grand wizard and epic person ever. That cliche. Defend that.
Ooh, I'm going to have a hard time with that one. What's the trope version of that?
So here's some submissions that we had. So Johan, Library of Vikings, submitted this one. He hates this trope. He said, the angsty teenagers somehow being smarter, wiser, and better with words than world leaders. That's a great point. We also had this submitted by our patron, Mikey, who said, a character being immediately competent and or better than everyone else without having any development earning their expertise. Disregard if the story begins during the middle of a character's journey in the world. But all these kind of cliche patterns were really, you're smarter with everything and you're kind of, it can link with the Chosen One trope sometimes, but what do you think? Is there a way to make that good? Is it always bad? What do you think, Rich?
Again, I think it comes down to the cost. Yep. What is the cost of that genius, and what are the obstacles in the way, and why? So I think if you make a story deliberately about, like, hey, look, it's not about the character's growth in practical terms. It's about the character's maybe social growth. So they are a genius, but they're terrible at actual communication to being an angsty teen. And so it's not their challenge of thinking of the right idea. It's how to convince others. That can be a compelling story of, yeah, sure, they got all the tools to make things work, but you have to work with other people. That's the challenge. So it's not, so you're focusing on different things, but
I get you.
I will say, like, especially if they're just smarter than everyone else and they're also likable, it's like, then it's like, okay, what do you got to do?
Where's your...
sorry.
Little phone call. But where is your... who is that? Is that a...
that's my internet.
Oh, okay.
That's not good.
You know what? It's fine.
I hope my internet's still connected. That'd be good.
But that cliche, Rich, you want to take a quick pause?
Oh, no, I'm just muting my phone. We're good.
Okay, good. So that cliche with... I have two examples. Mm-hmm. There's lots of examples, but one with the Kenobi show where Leia is a kid and just smarter, more competent. And it's the believability of if a kid's able to do this. Okay, what's the character growth? What's the consequence? What are the stakes? Another more niche example is with the book by Mark Lawrence, The Library Trilogy.
Ah, yes.
What is the title of that book?
The Book That
Wouldn't Burn, yes. Where Laveria, not spoiling this, but Laveria is a smart character. And by her character growth and then, which go ahead, check out that book. We did a review for it. I didn't love the book. One of my complaints is Laveria and her character and that exact kind of cliche of where, again, can be done well if there's something that the intelligence or the genius of this character brings. For example, maybe part of their flaw and their growth they need is to be humbled. Maybe one of their things is be like, hey, they aren't as smart as they thought they were, they're still intelligent. Or maybe it's realizing that it's not their intelligence they need to work on, but it's their social skills they need to work on, or it's not their whatever that might be. Something that's
give you a real heart-wrenching example of movie-wise is Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
I haven't seen that film.
Oh my god, you haven't?
No.
Didn't we all watch it together?
I wasn't there. Oh. You didn't invite me.
That tracks.
No, you did. I didn't show up. No.
Well, no, so Rocket Raccoon.
Yeah.
Genius, but it's heart-wrenching.
Okay.
Heart-wrenching of actually being punished for their genius deliberately.
Interesting.
And having to, it's both their greatest asset and what makes them special, but also what causes them the most grief and pain.
Mm.
So both sides.
I'm glad it's done well there, because these, do you agree that the cliche is probably more annoying, because in a movie, when you see it, it's almost that wish fulfillment for the kid. Mm-hmm. Of you just know, are they just targeting, trying to make the kid look perfect so that they can sell toys? I don't know. I get a little bit in my head is when you see that in a cliche film, it's like, all right, they're just doing the thing.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It also is the annoying part of it is when they are apparently a genius and yet you don't really see them.
Exactly.
Like why? It just seems like the answers come to them rather than them working it out.
Yeah.
Which I would much rather see a very smart character work it out rather than like their thought process and like the creativity aspect of it rather than just like, oh, I already know. And then we don't get to see how they know. It's fun to see them. It's the great part about a mystery novel is when like the detective will like deliberately focus on something and go, and then move along and you go, what did they see? They clearly caught something, and then it adds you into it. So that's fun. So like for Kenobi, if Leia was showing moments of her intelligence but not fully explaining the answer, you know what I mean? Of like, oh, she's paying attention to this and she's picking up on that, and then we see how it all comes together, it'd be like, ah, that's cathartic. It's fun to see that.
Definitely. Yeah, it's one of those cases where I think all these cliches can technically be done well.
Yeah.
It's just, where do we more often than not see it in a poor light? And I think for this one, definitely. It's one of those that is becoming more and more annoying over time.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And
smart people are just annoying.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Rock, rock, hit, hit, bad, bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This next cliche, another one I really dislike. Okay. Miscommunication. The miscommunication.
I don't think you're going to have a lot of fight with me on this one.
The miscommunication cliche, what is so bad about that for you?
I'm trying to think of a way when it's done well, and actually I do. Wheel of Time. But it's deliberately it's frustrating. Even in Wheel of Time, it can be annoying and frustrating. It's kind of the point that it's miscommunication is stupid. Like it doesn't have, it's something that doesn't need to be there. And it's a really stupid obstacle that once you get over, you go, of course. But
yeah, the miscommunication is frustrating because there's a simple fix to it that you see as the reader that almost feels forced to keep the plot plotting.
Well, there's the key is, why is there miscommunication? Mm-hmm. Is the miscommunication there simply like the characters are acting odd for themselves and it's just for the plot's sake? Or are they miscommunicating because it's a character flaw of they don't communicate well, of they're too arrogant, or they are too inside their own head. They're not willing to
real
see
time enough. Stubborn.
There we go.
They're all stubborn. Yeah.
Well, the whole thing, not even just stubborn, but they don't, they're not able to see a different person's perspective. And so they miscommunicate often, or they don't trust one another. So they are miscommunicating, thinking, oh, I have to lie. I have to hold back information. If there's a reason for it, then okay.
Fry from our Patreon says, miscommunication and all of its consequences, it can be done right, like in Mistborn, for example, but usually it's just an amateur and frustrating way to steer the plot in a specific direction. So exactly what we're getting at here, where if it's just there for the plot to keep plotting, feels wrong, but if it's tied to the character, if it's part of their flaw, their motivation, you can work it in.
Yeah.
You'd be like, hey, this is something they actually have to get over, and it's something they succeed by the end of the novel, rather than, why don't you just tell Rich what you actually think, that you don't want to do this podcast anymore? Why don't you just end it?
Why don't you just do it? But, you know, you're afraid. I get it.
One day, I'll get over that flaw. And you just won't see another episode.
One day you'll get the actual courage to quit.
So that is going to be a very annoying cliche, miscommunication. And I don't think too much else to say on that other than bad, but hey, make it a part of the character. Do something interesting with it.
Even when it's done well, like even when you can do it well, I don't think it's amazing.
No.
It's not like we're the chosen one. Done well is awesome.
Yeah.
Miscommunication done well is okay.
I think there's a caveat too with a lot of these tropes, a lot of these cliches, you can almost get away with making them better if it's more whimsy. It's more absurd. Discworld stuff. So when you have a Discworld type world and there's miscommunication there between characters, or if there's the back and forth, again, is almost in a parody of the trope. Or
parody a trope is to make it a cliche. A cliche in many ways is a cheap parody of a trope.
Mm-hmm. When it's clearly a parody, and when you're almost making it that cliche, not a cliche because you're doing something new and inventive with it to make it fun. So that I think these kind of the miscommunication can maybe be done in a lot of humorful books and movies. Think of all the My Cousin Vinny is a great example where the communication between characters, it's the whole fun of the dialogue is they're saying things to the other character and they're getting they think they're talking about something different.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're sitting there going, how funny is that, that one person's thinking this, the other's thinking that, and they're communicating but actually not meaning the same thing, creates humor. So when miscommunication is used for a bit, for humor, for something between the characters, I love that. That's fun.
I mean, yeah. My Cousin Vinny is just full of that.
Oh, no, it's a genius film. It's an amazing film.
It's an objectively perfect film.
We agree. Yeah, look at that. We should do a review on it. So, hey, did I defend miscommunication a little bit there?
Actually, you did.
I did a little bit for it. Okay, I did my job. All right. I saw you being too negative and had to flip it. So.
Yeah.
This next one here is this is another frustrating one. You guys did a good job. So, magic to easily solve problems.
Ah.
The magic solution the quick solve.
Oh, we learned this brand new spell that solves all the issues again.
Exactly. Murdy from our Patreon said, someone getting their hand cut off and magically repairing for no reason. So
she's referencing a specific book that we talked about.
Don't want to spoil
our book club.
Don't want to spoil it, but there is that happens in one of the books and it comes back. And also we can talk about Luke Skywalker.
Sure.
That's Murdy used Luke Skywalker as another example. So that's one. We had Fire CY from our Patreon said, it's kind of niche, but the one I absolutely cannot stand is the main character becomes a god/deity, and at the end of the book magically resolves all the problems. It's a specific type of Deus Ex Machina that annoys Fire CY. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of, by the end of the book, or is it a Deus Ex Machina type magic solution? Is it you grow your arm back and takes away the consequences of what that could mean for the story? And a lot of this is going to your point you made earlier, where what are the consequences to this trope/cliche? Again, trope turning into cliche. So
a cliche doesn't understand why a trope did what it did.
Yeah.
They just do what the trope does without any of the underlying reasons and fundamental consequences to it.
Exactly. Because then when magic solves problems done well, it's when you one of Brandon Sanderson's law in magic is the ability for the reader to enjoy the said magic is directly correlated to how well they understand said magic. Is their enjoyment is directly to how much they understand it when magic solves problems. I kind of butchered that, but that's his point with it, where, hey, if I understand how the magic works and you set up for me that the arm growing back thing isn't just a thing like that, but your arm, you set up from the get-go that their arm grows back when this situation and under these circumstances, and they're able to do this in a unique way.
Or like, it leads to something cool. I'll even do something like Army of Darkness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Cuts off the arm and it gets like a metal hand, which ultimately doesn't do much. But then he puts on the cool chainsaw. Yeah. It's like, cool. Awesome. Like, it's just part of the, it's not imagined. I get it, but it's the removal of consequences, but it's also, it can be fun if you turn a disadvantage into an advantage. So, they lost their hand, but now they gain something else in a creative, fun way.
Exactly. So that is the magic to easily solve problems cliche. And finally, we're getting to mine. They finally made it on the list. My least favorite cliche, the won't kill bad guys, the big bad. The won't kill bad guys, the killing through henchmen, we talked about it briefly. Do you have anything more to say on that of why it's bad?
Why it's bad is because it doesn't make sense. If it's the case of they're willing to kill all the henchmen and all the other things, but they're not willing to kill the big bads, like, well, that just doesn't make sense at all. And that just breaks it. I don't think there's any way to fix that specifically other than I have fixed.
What's that?
You're willing to kill a henchman. You come to the big bad and you can't kill the big bad because you find out who they're related to. Like, it's your father. Yeah. It's something.
It's personal.
It becomes personal.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's annoying when the character gives like a whole moral lesson of like, I'm better than you. I won't actually stoop down to your level. And like, murder is wrong. It's like, well, they massacre.
In a way, Luke millions. Does that. Luke kills a bunch of people. And then goes to Darth Vader and says, I'm going to change him.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Oh, no, it is.
That's exactly what it is.
It's exactly what it is. But why does it work? Because it's personal.
It's his father. Yeah.
It's his father. Yeah. And that's the whole thing of, yeah. And
it just goes to show it's
a rejection of Palpatine's ideal in the dark side.
So you can kill aimlessly until it matters to you.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's very selfish. Luke, bastard.
That's the main thing, is we know that clones and stormtroopers, their lives have no value.
Mm.
That's what we're learning, is that no named people that don't have enough social media followers, they are just irrelevant. You know, no human value at all.
You actually don't have value if you don't go to our social media and check out follow us.
Yeah.
If that's your, so there's different versions. It goes us because we have people that watch us, right?
That is true.
Anybody with bigger numbers than us,
they're worth more than
they're
us.
They're worth more.
Morally.
Societally.
Ethically, just everything around them.
And
they're more intellectually smart.
Actually.
They are worthy of attention.
Now you and I, we have to take how many views we get and split them in half since there's two of us. We can't both share those.
Ah, true.
And then we have to fight over who gets to take the others. So who has more social...
That's the real threat of danger, is a real quick way for one of us to just double our human life value. Mm-hmm. Is if I kill you, I take the entirety of our social value.
Wow.
I can double it overnight.
Wow.
But then I don't have someone to like do the work of the channel for me. And so ultimately it's a short-term strategy.
Short-term gain though.
Short-term gain though. Yeah.
So with the won't kill you, so you'd be willing to kill me as a henchman is the point.
Yeah. Well, you are a henchman, but you're a very helpful henchman.
I'm the mini boss that helps the big bad you walk into the room at the end where it's like, okay, bad guy. And then the secretary, that's all he's been helping the bad guy.
Yeah.
Secretary gets their brains blown out, then deal with the bad guy. But I make it to the end. I make it to the very end, then get killed. I'm page like
as soon as you serve your
your role. Yeah.
Your role. Yeah.
Okay. I'm with that. So this one also frustrates me, and it happens in one of my favorite series. I'll admit, protagonist plot armor.
Yeah.
Plot armor. Yeah, you see it everywhere. Plot armor thoughts.
I mean, in general, it's annoying. It just can kind of take you out of it. Thing is, how much of that is plot armor is just the plot happening? And so, like, the character goes through amazing things and survives. Like, if they die, then, the story kind of ends.
It happens a bit in Red Rising, I'll admit.
Thing is, it happens in some books more than the others. There's a couple of them. I don't think it happens really that often. Like, you know, Golden Sun, I think, has very little plot armor, if at all.
Now, when we're talking about plot armor, too, you're directly referencing to, hey, is it just the plot happening and the protagonist survives? The saying that this isn't me saying this, other people said this, but looking at the two phrases of they're the protagonist because they survive, or they survive because they're the protagonist. Changing those words around of when a plot happens and you feel like they had plot armor, I think that was a poor job, and you feel like the author wrote themselves into a corner.
Mainly, so it's a big lack of agency. Yeah. If they get out of a situation because someone comes in, saves the day, and it's just, you know, random chance, it's like, okay, they didn't get out of it themselves, versus they get out of it because they made a friend. Even if it's someone came in and saved the day, if that person is someone that they helped earlier on in the story and like made that connection, and then they say it's like, okay, it feels more coherent and not so plot armory. But if it just happens, or it's just luck and that's not a part of the system, it doesn't work that well. Versus, again, Wheel of Time writes it into
Wheel
the story.
Wheel of Time does every trope.
Well, here's the thing. Robert Jordan was a genius. He cut it off at the pass. He knew, like, hey, you know what's easier to do? What if I just deal with these tropes? And, like, what if plot armor is so nice to use. So much easier. What if I wrote plot armor into the literal magic system? Magic system has plot armor. It's a function. And then, like, goes with that. Like, you go, oh, yeah, wow. This character's like, man, I have plot armor. And everyone's like, yeah, that's the magic system.
You know what
system.
Else is that? Dungeon Crawler Carl.
Yeah.
Dungeon Crawler Carl has built-in plot armor. So, again, when it's built-in and it makes sense for the story, great.
Yeah,
you're following
you can
along.
Do it. It's fun.
You don't, the suspension of disbelief's there. But as soon as you have, especially with a high stakes grimdark, these consequential books where your Game of Thrones, your Song of Ice and Fire, where if the point is you can't, anyone could die. If the point is, look, it's very real where this political drama, this space opera, anybody can go. And then when you feel there's plot armor, you're going, wait, this is not what you promised me this whole time, which is part of the reason why, part of many reasons why season 8 failed.
Mm.
Lots of reasons why it failed, but it's one of those things where it loses that touch of, you promised me that this was the high stakes, anyone could go, and now, wait, why is this character should die if you're trying to if you're trying to present something more real and gritty?
It just really takes you out of it.
Oh,
It takes you out of the story and going, oh, the author couldn't figure out a way for the character to get out on their own. And they wrote themselves into a corner and had to pull this out of their ass. And that's what it reads like.
Now, there's plenty more cliches people mentioned. I really want to do a quick throw out there of some of the lunatics out there.
Oh, okay, good.
Some of you loons out there, I'm going to reference you by name.
Some of the great examples of why democracy is cringe. These are the people, if you go, hey, democracy is a pretty cool idea, you throw them these examples of, like, you really want their say in things? Yeah.
Look at this. One person. Let me make sure I get your name right, okay? You better be watching this. Here we go. I just have to control
F. I thought you had it up.
I do. I had to control F to find. Okay. Lena 1842. Thank you so much for watching. But besides that, Lena says this. It's a hit or miss, but the standard fantasy animal sidekick cliche. Lena, sidekick animals are always cool. They're never done wrong, and you're the problem. That's all I have to say.
That's pretty fair.
So think Discworld books. Think even in the book that wouldn't burn, the book that I didn't like that much, there was an animal, and I loved it. There was a doggo. There was a bird, I'm pretty sure. Great. Anytime there's an animal, a talking animal, how can you do animals wrong? Even a bad writer can't do... No, I'm not referring to Mark Lawrence for this. He's a fantastic writer. A bad book, bad writer, even the animal will come up on top. You just can't do it wrong, ever. Full stop. I'm going full in.
Thing is, it's one of the... It could be a cliche, but it almost always works. It works. It's so easy to make it work, and it somehow always does.
It's so good. You're in agreement with me, right?
Oh, I'm in agreement. No, she's wrong. I think she... Lena?
Lena, I think so. But
I'm assuming.
Lena... Never watch us again. No, please watch. So that's my thought. I'm curious too on anybody that wants to comment on when they've seen the animal done wrong. If we missed any cliches throughout here, there's plenty more you all submitted. If you guys want us to do a part two for this or just talk cliches in the future, comment to let us know. Otherwise, we won't redo it. Just, hey, if you really like this, want us to talk about it more, do let us know. If we don't see that, we'll go on to other topics.
Yeah.
And go for there. So this has been... Another ramble. This teetered my totter. Did it cringe your democracy?
Yeah, it did make me... The last one made me lose even more faith in democracy. And it's already pretty low.
But for the most part, they had some great takes.
That is true. I mean,
little faith
we
restored.
We did take almost every single cliche and talked our way into saying it actually could be good. It's not that annoying. We did.
In some ways, we did.
We took everything they said and said, what about the opposite?
We did some whataboutism.
Yeah.
The whole time.
We did. We were contrarian.
What about subscribing and doing the notification bell? I don't know.
What about joining our Patreon and giving us money by, you know, buying bookmarks of ours that we have and things?
What about T-shirts? Just checking out our next episode and not listening to any of this? Because you know what? Honestly, if I was listening to a podcast and people promoted this, I do get the viewer. I don't like things. Comment. I'm one of those lurkers.
You're a silent enjoyer.
I'm a lurker. All the people that I love and support, I watch their stuff, laugh along. I'm intrigued by it. I very rarely interact with things. So I get it.
I appreciate you lurkers. We appreciate you.
Anybody that's never said a thing, honestly, you're the real ones.
Yeah.
Probably the bad message to give. We appreciate all of you. This has been another episode of To The Ramble.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye, all.
See y'all next episode, week, sometime, Friday, Monday.
Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.